The Guardian.
Corbyn didn't just emerge pretty much unscathed in last night's Battle of the Jeremies. He positively thrived, but with no face-to-face TV debates, both leaders claimed victory in their battles with an awkward audience and a slightly OTT pitbull Paxman.
Meanwhile, despite the calendar and a major wobble, it doesn't quite feel like the end of May. She's back on the campaign trail today, banging the drum on Brexit.
I'm Owen Jones.
And I'm Jonathan Friedland, and we're joined in the studio today by The Observer's chief leader writer, Sonia Soda.
Okay, first things first, it wasn't quite a TV debate. Obviously, Theresa May made sure that there wasn't going to be a head-to-head confrontation. It wasn't quite an interview either. Whatever it was, both camps are saying they won. What do we think? Sonia?
So I thought Jeremy Corbyn did really well. I thought he performed very well, but I think performing well and convincing people to vote for you are actually two very different things. And I'm not sure his performance, although it was a solid, robust one, I'm not sure it's one that's going to have won lots of people round. I thought Theresa May actually also did fine. I think she looked a little bit more rattled, particularly under questioning from Jeremy Paxman. I thought she had quite a tough time from Jeremy Paxman, actually. But again, I think her camp will be pleased with how she done. I think both of them avoided any disasters, which is the number one thing you've got to do when you're going into a live TV situation like this. I'm not sure it's the kind of live TV event that will have changed minds, as I was saying, in relation to Jeremy Corbyn. But I think those are quite rare anyway. So I think it's very rare that you get a TV debate or a live interview that really fundamentally changes the public's mind about a politician. So I think both camps will feel like a number of boxes ticked, but I suspect it will have very little impact on the campaign.
I think that must be right, actually, because even in the United States, where they have these absolute 90-minute head-to-head debates, it's actually really rare where there's been a game changer, and this just didn't offer any of those moments. There's a big difference as well between who's watching the whole 90 minutes and then the clips that make it into the news afterwards. I always think that's quite important. You know, somebody spotted that this wasn't even trending on Facebook, you know, and they tweeted out saying, no normal people are watching this.
It's freaks, you know, like
us. It's only that. And so that,
hey,
that,
I'm normal, guys.
And then, and so in a way, what mattered, I thought, was the sort of 10 o'clock news afterwards. And there, I think what you say is absolutely right. In the Q&A with the audiences, Jeremy Corbyn came over as quite relaxed, quite affable, not the sort of monster that some of them may have been expecting after 2 years of how he's been depicted. And, you know, quite chatty and fluent, and even managing to be quite sort of humorous with Jeremy Paxman. But as you say, that isn't necessarily the test that people are looking for in a prime minister. It's not just the sort of having a chat over the garden fence test, which is what they talk about often. It is about looking prime ministerial. And even though Theresa May did look quite nervous and sort of uncertain, there is just something about her. The best moments were when she was at her most dull, when she was quite sort of stolid and boring. And that looks to a lot of people a bit more like a prime minister.
It is interesting. I mean, she made this strategic decision to have a presidential style contest, that this was going to be the battle of the personalities, where the Conservative Labour would barely appear on buses and literature. It was always about Theresa May. And she began this campaign with astronomical personal ratings from a historical kind of level. Although it's interesting that she had the highest rating since Gordon Brown, just after he took over. And we all know, of course, how that ended. Now, caveats, clearly the Tories are still very much ahead in the average of polls. And on personal ratings, that gap has dramatically narrowed, given where we were at the beginning. And there's always this sense in a campaign when it's almost like a candidate shrinks slightly, the ever-shrinking candidate. She does look a reduced as a figure. She was nervous, on edge. She's kept away from the media and the public as much as possible. I think we can see why. And what we saw last night was Jeremy Corbyn, whatever I think critics and supporters alike would say, he thrives on a campaign. He thrives speaking and debating with the public. She clearly just did not like that one bit.
No, I think she didn't. I suspect she's also been very affected. I think she probably thought that this campaign against Jeremy Corbyn was going to be fairly plain sailing, actually. And I think we've seen her make some real rookie errors, particularly around the manifesto, particularly around social care. And I suspect that will have really affected her and the people around her. And I think that came through in some of the nerves that you saw last night. And I thought where she was on her weakest, actually, was when members of the audience were asking her about things like cuts to the police force. I mean, you have police officers asking about police cuts, people who work in the NHS asking about NHS cuts. She came across as a bit dismissive, I think. And then when she was pushed on the detail of some of her policies by the presenter and by members of the audience, she was sort of saying, well, on social care, on the winter fuel payment, there'll be a consultation after the general election. Now, she's a prime minister who called a general election. She's been prime minister for a good few months. I'm sorry, but saying there's going to be a consultation on something as important as what level are you going to cap social care costs at, it just doesn't ring true for me.
They were both helped, though, weren't they, by the interviewer, Jeremy Paxman, who did not have his best evening, It's got to be said. And it was something quite dated as a style, that sort of Rottweiler style, talking over them, shouting, barking. It enabled Jeremy Corbyn to look like the more reasonable guy up against this sort of grumpy other Jeremy. I think it gave a lot of space, actually, for Theresa May. As we're recording this podcast, Woman's Hour's been on the radio, where a very different style, from all accounts, we haven't heard it, but a different style of interviews been conducted by Emma Barnett, where much sort of quieter and more forensic. And it's made me think that style of interviewing, which we've seen some of in the campaign, can be more effective. The uncomfortable moments, I did think, for both of them did come in the interview stage. Well, actually, for Jeremy Corbyn, it came in the interview stage. There was that bit about drones and airstrikes and everything else. Would you order one? You know, a lot of Guardian readers will just have no problem at all with what Jeremy Corbyn said. I'd want to see the evidence and hesitate. For other people, I wonder if that struck a memory of when he was asked about Shoot to Kill after the Paris attacks in November 2015 and sort of said, I'm not sure I would do that, you know. And the hesitance, there is a streak in the electorate that does want to hear of a prime minister when confronted with an enemy, will just take them out. Not nuanced, not subtle, maybe not admirable, but I wondered if that period was quite sticky for him. Didn't last very long, but it did, I noticed, it did make it into the news and other things afterwards.
I mean, quickly on Theresa May, I think, I mean, the worry I would have if I were her camp was it's worse for a politician not to be disliked, but to be ridiculed, to become an object of laughter.
The laughter wasn't good, was
it? I mean, it's the same with Gordon Brown. I remember, look, we know the Tories remain very much ahead. They're not where Gordon Brown was when it was all falling to pieces. But, you know, Gordon Brown, I remember a poll showing something like a majority of the public felt sorry for him. Last night, people weren't booing her so much. They were laughing at her. And they laughed when she attacked Labour for not costing their policies. Yep. Labour did cost their policies. She didn't. She was ridiculed about her constant U-turns, her inconsistency. How could the EU leaders trust her? She would just be regarded as a blowhard and all the rest. So the difficulty for her potentially is that authority is beginning to dissipate at this point in the campaign.
Yeah, I definitely think there's something right about that. And there is this big irony, isn't there, Owen? As you were saying earlier, this campaign was supposed to be all about her and not the Conservatives. And I think her brand has taken a real knocking, actually, the whole strong and stable thing, as a result of some of the U-turns that we've seen. I think, coming to your point, Jonathan, about, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's sort of potentially hairier moments during last night, I think where they would have really struck home is probably with older voters. So, you know, the topic of the IRA.
Right, only with older voters, probably.
But then again, that's who Labour's really got to win round. And if we look at why the polls have been narrowing, it's because Labour's actually doing really well with younger voters. And I think the concern for Labour has to be, in the polls where they're doing best, it's the polls where they sort of give a bit of a boost to young turnout, because they base it on whether people themselves in the polls say they're going to turn out or not. So I think for Labour, turnout is going to be a really big issue, especially amongst younger voters.
Will those young'uns turn out? We will find out very soon. Well, you can leave us your thoughts on our podcast page, and do follow the latest news on our election live blog at theguardian.com.
We've got a question here from Kevin, and it comes on the day in which the SNP, the Scottish National Party, launched their manifesto. And given that context, it's quite a loaded question. It says, will any party have the guts to reform the Barnett formula? So, Sonia, for people coming new to this, explain the Barnett formula for us, and why asking the idea of the SNP having the guts to reform it?
Oh, so this is a bit of a test for me. So the Barnett formula is a formula that sort of sets the amount of, I suppose you could call it subsidy. That might be regarded as a bit pejorative, actually, but it sets the level of funding and the way that the funding formula works between England and Scotland. And there's always been a gripe, I think, amongst some English voters that actually Scotland gets a bit of a boost to its finances from, you know, what would be considered to be the English budget. Now, the SNP have always argued for stronger tax-raising powers, but they've never really used them since getting them. So I think the question is, are they going to sort of stand on their own two feet and become independent financially, which is obviously, you know, if you're going for independence, that's sort of what you've got to demonstrate that you're able to do? Or are they going to sort of continue to fall back on that cash from England?
I suppose the traditional argument for the SNP was always about oil. But oil prices since the referendum, of course, have collapsed. So that's changed the dynamic a bit, hasn't it?
That's right. And it feels with Brexit as well, the economic situation in Scotland is so different around independence that that would be a real thorn in the side of, in a potential second independence referendum. That said, though, I do think that where the strength of the SNP's argument comes from is about national identity. That's what we saw in the referendum campaign. I don't think Nicola Sturgeon is in a position to win a second independence campaign, but I think those economic arguments probably feature a bit lower down in the pecking order.
And we're also told that they're going to signal that this election is not an independence election. In other words, they won't read into the result anything or any verdict on independence. They would say that, wouldn't they, given that what it appears to be, if the polls are right, that they're going to get quite a setback in this election, lose a few seats, and therefore they won't want to have anyone reading that as a sort of thumbs down to a second independence referendum. So they're getting that off the table from the outset. It is new territory for all of us. It's more or less for the first time since 2007 that the SNP go into an election on the sort of back foot and expected to lose rather than gain. So it's quite a big and new shift. Now, I want to talk about something in a way, the kind of dog that hasn't barked in this election, which is, let's remind ourselves of why this election was called. It was Theresa May who decided to call it 3 years ahead of time and said, I'm doing it because I'm getting sabotaged and impeded on Brexit. And this was meant to be the Brexit election. Give me a mandate to negotiate Brexit. And yet, how little has there been really about Brexit one way or the other? Now, we know or hear that that's going to change now and the Conservatives are going to get really back onto that. And there have been all kinds of cabinet ministers out today saying no deal better than a bad deal and, you know, wanting to shift the discussion. But it is an interesting one, why this hasn't been the Brexit election as advertised.
I think it's partly because of where the voters are, actually. So if you look at polling about how people who voted Remain in the referendum now feel, I think it's about half of people who voted Remain sort of have kind of accepted the result of the referendum and just want the government to get on with it.
So-called re-leavers, which I think is a terrible bit of jargon because it makes no sense, but that's what pollsters are calling.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't make much sense. But I think that's a really important phenomenon. And I think a lot of pundits going into this election thought that actually it would be easier to kind of reawaken those voters than it has been. So I think that's sort of one reason for it. I think it's interesting that Theresa May is sort of trying to make it, you know, part of her key offer again. And I think what we saw actually going back to the debate last night was some of her strongest moments in her interview with Jeremy Paxton was when she was sort of being very strong about, you know, no deal is better than a bad deal. But at the end of the day, it's just a soundbite. It doesn't really mean anything. I think she thinks it's quite safe territory for her in this election, which is kind of ironic given that she was a Remainer and campaigned for, albeit not, you know, as forcefully as some other people.
That was an interesting moment in the Paxton interview when you reminded her that she was, and reminded us that she was a Remainer.
So, I mean, the premise of the election was false for two reasons, arguably. One, she said she was being sabotaged in the House of Commons and in Parliament when Labour, to the chagrin of the despondent Remainer, I was going to say Ramona, but I won't go all Daily Mail, but they voted through Article 50. So there wasn't that sabotage. The second was an increased majority would strengthen a negotiating hand when EU governments have absolutely no interest in how many seats she has whatsoever.
And we heard on this podcast our German colleague, indeed, Matthias Kolb from Süddeutsche Zeitung, saying the exact opposite, that if she gets a big mandate, Europeans think then she's got the strength to actually give us a softer Brexit.
But I mean, when you knock on the door, I've been knocking on doors all over the country now, and I've almost never heard Brexit mentioned whatsoever, whatever people's political persuasions. I think what we have
seen... What's the theory? We need a theory for that, of why it hasn't come up.
Well, I think it is partly that, you know, in terms of... Brexit has a peculiar obsession, particularly amongst people who live in London. People who really don't like Brexit are disproportionately, probably, you know, in the Guardian kind of world, represented. But out there, it's just not people's obsession. They think, we voted as a country, now we need to move on. That is generally my impression. What does seem to have become the story of the election is, as you were saying, the generational divide. That clearly, to some degree, does, you know, there's a correlation with Remain and Leave. But there's a massive generational divide where Labour now have a huge lead amongst people under 45 and 50, frankly, whilst the Tories have an astronomical lead amongst those over 50. And that generational divide is unprecedented in polling history. It's astonishing.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think it sort of reflects where we are, actually, how the debate has shifted in the last 2 or 3 years, the way that young people are feeling about housing, about jobs. But it is very, very stark, as you say. But I still think that turnout is going to be so differential that it will probably be older groups that win this election.
That's certainly how it always has been. Yes. And this big gap in the polling organisations is which ones believe young people will act as they have in the past and stay away, and which ones believe, take what younger people are saying at face value, that they will come out, because that's what they're telling pollsters. And just on the Brexit thing, I think one of the consequences of it, the fact that it isn't a Brexit election, and I have to say, Owen, I agree with you, I think people basically think it's settled. It's almost too soon to have a Brexit election. If there'd been the negotiations and then a deal, then you can imagine a 2020 election would have been a kind of referendum on the deal, and that's why Theresa May didn't want to have it. But as it is, it isn't a Brexit election. People think, we've told you what to do, get on with it. But one of the big casualties of that has been the Lib Dems, because the Lib Dems needed to go into this election, I think, as the sort of continuity remain, the sort of remain resistant, still in the caves, haven't heard the war is over sort of thing. They needed that to be their sales pitch. And they could have, theoretically, in the most remain seats, you've mentioned London, in other places, you know, there was a world in which they could have picked up 40 or 50 seats, picking up every one of those sort of Richmond Park type seats. Hasn't happened for them at all.
Well, I mean, it was clearly their strategy. And in some ways, it was a good strategy, because I think that the question is always, when you're the Lib Dems, how do you differentiate yourself, especially when you just had quite a big hammering in the 2015 election? So in some ways, it was kind of the obvious strategy to go for, but it hasn't succeeded, I think. I'd be really surprised if they do significantly better than the polls suggest in the general election. And that is to do with the fact that this hasn't been the Brexit election. It's also, I think, interesting about whether this election was timed right in terms of a mandate. And I always thought that, you know, going to the country in a general election, you know, a year after we voted in Brexit, was absolutely the most terrible way to kind of seek a mandate for this. The only way to do it that makes sense, I think, would have been to actually go to a second referendum after you've got the terms of your deal and you're putting something concrete to people. They may have seen a bit more about what's going on with the economy, whether it's for ill, for worse. And so it always felt to me like politicians were talking this up. Theresa May was talking this up as a Brexit election, but she was always going to get a mandate almost for whatever she wanted to do with Brexit.
Well, on the Lib Dems, I think what we've seen is actually a vindication argument of what Labour did. Because actually siren voices, including those who are credited with having sophisticated political antennae, like Alistair Campbell, felt that Labour should oppose Article 50. Now, that was the position of the Liberal Democrats. It's obviously not worked in this election. But I would have argued, and see what you think about this, that and I wrote about this earlier on in the year, was that the Labour leadership were correct not to oppose Article 50, because then an election could be triggered on the basis they were subverting the will of the British people in a country where about 421 constituencies out of 650 voted to leave. But those who rebelled on the Labour ranks were also correct, because they represent solidly Remain seats. People like Clive Lewis in Norwich, Rupert Hook in Ealing, can go around their constituency saying, well, we rebelled against Labour, so they can cater for that constituency where there's a heavy Remain majority, can't they?
Well, I think it was always going to be too much to expect. So, you know, I voted for Remain. I'm sure it won't come as a surprise to listeners.
What?
But I always thought it was asking too much of a Labour Party to oppose Article 50 out and out after you've just had a referendum. I mean, that's what kind of referendums are for. But so I think it's very difficult for any elected representative, actually, if they represented an out constituency, to go in opposing Article 50 out and out. I think that was very difficult. And
like,
I think
Doncaster, for example, can you imagine 70% voted Leave?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I would have liked to have seen more of, though, I think, from the Labour Party was maybe just being a bit smarter in terms of the amendments to the bill that went through. It would have been better to see some more robust safeguards, I think, coming back to this idea of the mandate for Brexit. Now, fine, perhaps a second referendum was never going to get through, but a more meaningful, safer parliament. I mean, Keir Starmer claims that he did get a more meaningful, safer parliament, but actually I'm not quite sure that that's right. So that's what I would have liked to see more of. But I think you're right, Owen. I actually think, not even from a strategy perspective, but from a democratic legitimacy perspective, you can't ask people who represent constituencies that voted out to go in full throttle on a Remain argument. I mean, I think that's probably why referendums are not a great idea, personally.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I think I probably disagree with both of you on the strategy question. I think actually you could have said the democratic mandate is for leaving the European Union 100%. But it wasn't for leaving the single market. And therefore, until we actually know what triggering Article 50 entails, we are not going to give you that blank check until we know that that's what you're going to fight for. I think you could have made that argument. But where I do agree is the fact that they didn't means there was no way this could ever be a Brexit election, because you had two parties exactly. against each other who both voted to trigger Article 50. And therefore, the ability for this election to be a referendum was taken away at that point.
And Theresa May wanted that. She wanted Labour to oppose Article 50.
She did.
Then there would have been hysteria from the Tory media, yeah. which was their subverting the will of the British people, yeah. and the election would be very different.
And it would have been clearer. It would have been very different. All right, we are almost out of time, but you can follow us on Twitter at Guardian Podcasts. Sonia is at Sonia Soda, S-O-D-H-A. Owen is at Owen Jones 84, and I'm at Friedland.
So before we go, a quick bit of recommended reading. We'll link to all the pieces on the podcast page. Now, Jonathan, what's got your eye?
Well, a lot of people are talking about this piece. It's Rachel Sylvester on the opinion pages of The Times. She's a columnist there. And she's written a piece about how fear is sort of run out of road as a political device. She makes a very good case that Project Fear has failed in a series of times it's been tested. Her examples being the referendum where Remain tried to make people fear leave, didn't work, and that the attempt by Theresa May to make people fear a Corbyn government is not working as planned. I suppose the counter arguments on you would be that actually fear did work quite well for David Cameron when he said you should fear a Miliband SNP coalition, and it kind of worked in Scotland because in the end, you know, no won over yes. What do you think?
So I think fear can work, but I think it's a sign of an election where people haven't got anything positive to say. And it doesn't make people feel particularly good. And I don't think it works as well as strategies when a potential prime minister is going out to the country and saying, you should vote for me because of this.
It was interesting. It was Theresa May who said, coined the phrase the nasty party, but has she brought it back with a vengeance? My piece is Steve Richards in The Guardian. Whatever the results, he says, the election has pushed the centre ground to the left, and he notes that the Conservatives, for example, refused to rule out tax increases. We have, of course, them, some would say, pillaging the Labour manifesto of 2015 on the energy cap, energy bills. I mean, I don't know what you think. For me, I think rhetorically things have shifted to the left on the economy. You have the Tories trying to, you know, when Theresa May became Prime Minister, being on the side of the just about managing and all the rest of it, the need for the state to intervene, the end of socialism and libertarian economics and so on. In practice, in terms of the IFS are predicting that we'll have continuing austerity for the next few years, in terms of the real times drastic cuts to in-work benefits, which will really hit just about managing people, if we're going to use that phrase, I would say in rhetoric, yes, there has been a shift. In substance, not so much.
Right, well, that's all we've got time for today. Our thanks to Sonia Soda. Do make sure you're subscribed to Election Daily wherever you get your podcasts. And we're back tomorrow. For now, thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.